Do you remember the unwanted FIFA kiss back in August when Mr. Luis Rubiales, the former president of the Spanish Football Federation, forced a kiss on Ms. Jenny Hermoso? Well, this week, FIFA banned him from all football-related activities for 3 years. But this episode is not about him. It's about the long struggle of women in Spain for equal rights.
For example, the hegemonic gender system at the turn of the century was the so-called ideology of domesticity, which was common to many countries because it was given shape in Great Britain from the mid-19th century onwards. But in Spain, it took the form of the perfecta casada. This is the perfect married woman. Up until then, there was this idea that women were inferior to men from the intellectual point of view. But from the mid-19th century onwards, there was this idea that men and women were equal in their intellectual abilities, but they were allocated complementary functions within society. Exactly, but it wasn't true. I mean, this equality wasn't real because when women were asking for the right to vote in many countries, such as Great Britain, the United States, etc., they were denied that right on the basis of this complementarity of social functions. What happened if the husband killed his wife or her lover by catching them in the act? And this is that the husband would be condemned just to banishment.
I'm sorry, can we hold here for a second? So let's say you're a woman, your husband beats you. In 1935, you get a valid divorce because he's harassing you. But all of a sudden, in 1939, that same...
And you got married again.
And you got married. Oh, there you go. That's even more complicated. You're married again. And in 1939, that same abusive husband is now legally your husband?
Absolutely, yeah. That was the case, yeah. The legislation and in shaping the legislation for the Second Republic. I
don't know if you want to say women become MPs, members of parliament, but they still cannot vote.
Exactly. So before having the right to vote.
Interesting. Well, it's interesting. Okay.
Well, maybe I should have told you. Uh-huh. But the main idea that the husband had to protect the wife, but the wife due obedience to the husband was in place up until the democracy, the nowadays democracy. It's also called the law of yes is yes. I'm sure you've came across this expression, CSC, Ley de CSC, which actually focuses on the consent by the victim in order not to give the opportunity to the juries to actually discredit the victim's testimony.
Did you know that many victories in Spain's women's rights movement have not been permanent, and the forward steps for women's rights in Spain have not progressed linearly? There have been many cultural and political backlashes to this progress in Spain, some of which, quite sadly, resonate with pushbacks and backlashes against women's rights right here in America. Hey there, news peelers. Today is Friday, November 3rd, 2023. And this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how do we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars, enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee, or your favorite drink, or both, and let's get into it. Mr. Rubiales has labeled Ms. Hermoso's allegations of a non-consensual kiss as a social assassination that is predicated on false feminism. And many are referring to this incident as Spain's Me Too moment. But as my guest, Dr. Marta del Moral, explains, Spain joined the Me Too movement several years ago after the horrific La Manada rape case, in which five men gang-raped an 18-year-old woman and filmed themselves repeatedly attacking her. And get this, one of the rapists was a member of the Civil Guard, which is the oldest law enforcement agency in Spain and is one of the two national police forces there. By the way, in English, La Manada means the pack, as in a pack of wolves. Dr. Del Moral tells us about the trial of these men and the outrage it caused in Spain. As for Mr. Rubiales' reference to feminism, Dr. Del Moral explains that after this case, the La Manada rape case, for the first time in Spain's history, the term feminism was not considered pejorative. Rather, it had a positive connotation. As Dr. Del Moral takes us through the history of women's rights in Spain, you will note that this history is closely tied to the history of the fight for freedom, the history of dictatorships, populist politics, and world events. For me as a girl dad, the biggest takeaway from my conversation with Dr. Del Moral was that, regardless of whether you're in Spain or in America, the movement for women's rights is not an event. It's not something that happened in our old calendars, those old calendars with our mothers and grandmothers' hand-scribbled notes. It's something that is happening now and should continue to happen. I know I'm injecting my own personal opinion here, but I can't help it. This is personal. It's about my wife. It's about my daughter. So you bet we'll have more episodes about women's rights. We already have several episodes on this important subject, and my goal is to create a whole series on women's rights history. So please don't hesitate to share your suggestions about the history behind this important topic with me, and you can contact me on our homepage at historybehindnews.com. Dr. Del Moral is a professor of gender equality at the Complutense University of Madrid, also known as UCM. She directs the research group Gender Relations in the Contemporary World, an Interdisciplinary Perspective from History, Geography, and Law, where she has investigated women's participation in local governments. She has received many awards and prizes for her research and also obtained many teaching awards, including this one that I just think is super cool, the Students' Union Your Awesome Award in the University of Bath, England. Examples of her projects include 1, Gender, Commitment, and Transgression in Transnational and Intergenerational Spaces, 20th Century, 2, Gender, Commitment, and Transgression in Spain, 1890 to 2016, 3, Transitions, Social Movements, and Democracy in the 20th Century, Spain in Comparative Perspective, and 4, Gender in Local Policies. To learn more about Dr. Del Moral, you can visit our academic homepage, the link for which is provided in the detailed caption of this episode. So, stay with me as Dr. Del Moral and I peel the history behind this news.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right, for the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Dr. Del Moral, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation with me. In the opening decades of the 20th century, women's suffrage movement was very active and ultimately successful here in America and also in Britain. So I think it's a sort of a good comparison period for us to start a conversation about women in Spain, their rights and their activities. So can you please give us some general sense, sort of general context about women's rights and women's conditions in Spain during that time?
Okay, yes. Well, the first third of the 20th century in Spain witnessed the succession of three different political regimes. So,
Regimes in 30 years?
Yes, actually talk about three different contexts regarding the situation of women during this year. So, first, from 1875 to 1923, we had a liberal monarchy known as the Restauración. And then it was followed by the dictatorship of General Primo de Rivera from 1923 to 1930. And finally, the first democratic regime in Spanish history, which was the Second Republic from April 1931 until the end of the Civil War in 1939. So, we are talking about many changes and continuities regarding women's rights during these 30 years. For example, the hegemonic gender system at the turn of the century was the so-called ideology of domesticity, which was common to many countries because it was given shape in Great Britain from the mid-19th century onwards. But in Spain, it took the form of the perfecta casada. This is the perfect married woman, taking the title of a book by Fray Luis de León, which dates back from 1527.
So, oh, wow, 1527.
Exactly.
That's crazy. Okay. Talk about being out of touch with modern times. Okay.
Absolutely. So this ideal of the perfect married woman was about having men as the breadwinners and the political representatives of the family, whereas women were allocated the private space. So they were in charge of reproduction, but taking in away their sense, so meaning nursing, taking care of the infants and the dependent members of the family, but also, and more importantly, in my view, in socializing children in the rules and norms to become future citizens.
When was this book published?
The Perfecta Casada was published back in 1527.
I misspoke. What I mean is that when was it sort of brought back to life, this concept? Is it 1875 or later?
Well, it was never gone, really. But this idea, I mean, this new idea of equality within difference between the sexes, which was developed in Great Britain during the mid-19th century, uh-huh. which was, summarizing very basically, up until then, there was this idea that women were inferior to men from the intellectual point of view, but from the mid-19th century onwards, there was this idea that men and women were equal in their intellectual abilities, but they were allocated complementary functions within society. And the
kind of like equal but separate.
Exactly. Okay. Equal but different. So it was equal a way of justifying inequality, but based on different grounds. Not intellectual inferiority, but different social functions.
Okay.
So in Spain, this resonated within this idea of the perfect married women, because in a sense, it was allocating women the private realm, whereas men were in charge of the public.
I see. It makes sense. So they're in different contexts, they're equal, but in different contexts.
Exactly, but it wasn't true. I mean, this equality wasn't real because when women were asking for the right to vote in many countries, such as Great Britain, the United States, etc., they were denied that right on the basis of this complementarity of social functions. So the answer to that was that they had already a representation through their husbands or through their fathers, so they didn't need to have any their own voice in the public realm.
And this comeback to women that you don't need your own right to vote because you got your men, husbands, and fathers. This discussion is occurring through what period? 1875 to 1923, or all the way up through the end of 1930s?
Well, the This conversation took place in other countries during the mid-19th century, but the feminist movement, by asking for new right for granting rights for women, kept it alive until they were granted the right to vote and other changes within the legislation, both civil and criminal legislation. So in Spain, it was the same story. So even though the suffragist movement started later than, let's say, Great Britain or the United States, because in the case of Spain, it started in the 1880s and 1890s, mm-hmm. The conversation was open until the 1930s, and way after. So when women started getting some rights recognized, they kept on fighting for others. But then there were setbacks in this up until the end of the 20th century, obviously. So they were having these public debates for a long period of time, obviously.
And you were saying how these different three periods, political periods, each of them had different ramifications for women?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. So the legislation changed during these years. We can look into two different areas. So we can look at the legislation and the social norms in different ways. So, for instance, if we are talking about women's rights, as in most Europe, Spain carried out a process of legislative unification during the 19th century. And the first civil code in Spain was passed pretty late in comparison to other European countries. In Spain, it was passed in 1889. And the controversies over the influence of the Catholic Church in the regulation of marriage was the reason for this legislation to be passed so late, which is pretty significant in the case of women's rights. The Spanish Civil Code of 1889 was deeply influenced by the French Code of 1804. And this is also the case in most European countries, which were under the influence of Napoleon for some years. So in this sense, Spain is not an exception regarding women's rights, especially for married women, because married women's rights were notably restricted within wedlock. So wives owed obedience to their husband, husbands retained the rights to his wife's properties, parental authority was assigned to the husband, and a woman had to have her husband's permission to perform any civil act, such as working or starting a business or acting as a witness in front of a jury.
Wow, that seems very restrictive.
But it was the same all over Europe at the time.
It was the same, okay.
Exactly the same. So because of the spread of Napoleonic codes during the early 19th century.
Okay. Where do we go from there?
And then we also need to look at the criminal code of 1870, which also established differences between the sexes as regards as crimes such as adultery. For instance, adultery was discriminatory against women, as it was defined as the crime committed by a married woman and the man with whom she had intercourse. So only the married woman committed that such crime, not the husband. And yes,
you didn't say married man. You just said married woman.
Exactly, the married woman and the man with whom she had intercourse. He being aware only if he was aware of her marital status.
So if a married man has intercourse, has sex with another woman, let's say she's single, she's not even married, that's not adultery under this definition then?
Not adultery. It was considered amancebamiento, which is a special word, and only if the husband's infidelity was continuous and well known by the entire community. And in this case was called amancebamiento. So it was conceptualized as a different type of crime. And obviously it implied a minor punishment.
Oh, wow.
And it was the same all over Europe, because this is also an influence taken from the criminal code by Napoleon.
I see. Sometimes when you look at history and you have wow moments and shock moments till we realize that was 150, 160 years ago. Okay, so let's go on, please.
Maybe people listening would be interested in reading some more. So there's actually an excellent book published by Rowlett, which is about women's legal history in Europe from a comparative perspective. So this was edited by Sarah Kimball, Marion Revekamp, and it's called New Perspectives on European Women's Legal History. And it's about comparing all these countries in terms of their civil and criminal codes, and also about the initiatives led by female lawyers in order to change this legislation.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that, the title of that book. I'll drop a link for it in the detailed caption of our episode.
Okay. So if I may continue with women's rights.
Please.
Well, there's another interesting part within the criminal code, which is about what happens if the husband kills his wife or her lover by catching them in the act. And this is that the husband would be condemned just to banishment, but he would be exempt of any of or of punishment if the injuries caused were considered minor. So he had in a way that the legislation protected him, even if in the case of murdering his wife.
So it's just outright murder.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. But the punishment was only banishment. That was it.
Banishment what, from the community, not from,
yes, not from Spain, no, just yeah, whatever the judge would have decided. So maybe a few kilometers, or maybe leaving the city. That was the only punishment for that kind of crime.
How long was this the law in Spain?
Well, this is very interesting, because this was in place up until the Second Republic, even though changing this legislation was part of the feminist agenda during the first third of the 20th century, along with the right to suffrage. But it was reinstalled by Franco. So it was then in place from 1939, in some areas from 1936, up until 1975, but with some
I have
change.
So many so questions we need to...
yeah, so wait. I mean, in bulk. So there were minor changes thanks to the work by female lawyers from the 1950s onwards. Uh-huh. But the main idea that the husband had to protect the wife, but the wife due obedience to the husband, was in place up until the democracy, the nowadays democracy.
That takes us all the way to 1975.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow, that's so late. But before we get to 1975, let's go back to this early period that we're talking mm-hmm. about.
So there's another interesting piece of legislation, which is the Commercial Code of 1885, which is inspired on the same social norms. So the idea was that for a woman to have a business, she had to be independent from any male authority, meaning that she had to be either a widow or an independent single woman, or have the authority or the permission of her husband to actually conduct this business. So everything was inspired by the same ideas, the same ideology of domesticity, which is how we call it. And this was very much the same all over Europe, and following a different legal tradition, also in England. So, but because they didn't have the influence of the Napoleonic codes, but there were some traditions and norms which were similar to the ones followed by the continent.
Does at some point the trajectory of women's rights in these early decades, we're talking about early 1900 to 19, late 1930s, the end of the Second Republic. Does the trajectory of women's rights in Spain veer off from other European countries, sort of regress, stay back, fall back, where other countries advance, let's say Britain, France, I don't know, perhaps Netherlands?
Well, here, I mean, I would say that the biggest difference here was that Spain wasn't or never took part in the First World War. And that was significant in many ways, because up until 1918, in Spain, there were many women's groups fighting for women's rights in different areas. So we've got free thinkers, Republicans, and lay thinkers from the 1880s and 1890s fighting for changes in education. Then we've got the first women's groups in political parties, which were out of the political term between liberals and conservatives. So meaning the Socialist Party or the Republicans.
And you're saying socialist, not communist, huh?
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay.
From the split in 1919, we will have the communists too. But at the beginning of the century, we've got the socialists and the Republicans, and these women's groups are fighting for women's rights within the labor market, basically. And then from 1919, we've got in 1921, we've got the Communist Party, which will have a feminist, well, a female section, let's say. So all these groups and some others were fighting for different political agendas, but not specifically focused on the right to vote. There were also some associations fighting for the vote, but that wasn't their main concern. But then after 1918, when after the First World War, some countries granted the right to vote to their female population or part of their female population, such as Poland or England and so on and so forth, Russia, Soviet Russia. We've got a change, or we witness a change in the political agendas developed by these groups. Mm-hmm. So then we've got a new political agenda where the right to vote, enfranchisement, and the changes within the civil and criminal legislation was one of the main points within their agendas. And this also created conflicts within the groups. For instance, we've got the Women Socialist Group of Madrid, which was mainly focused on working women and their rights. And then after 1918, we see how their leaders are approaching suffragist leaders, and they are changing their agenda, and they are prioritizing the vote, the right to vote.
Changes
which are good for the entire female population, not just the blue collar workers.
Yeah.
So what we've got is a complete confrontation with the main leaders of the party, who decided to close the group because they couldn't keep it under their control.
Oh wow, that's fascinating.
And that happened in 1927. So that's interesting in terms of the trends.
So let me see if I got this right. In the first two decades of Spain's women's rights movements of various different kinds, the right to vote wasn't front and center. But after World War I, where the United States and eventually Britain, and as you termed it, identifying Poland and Russia, get the right to vote, that becomes an inspirational point also for women in Spain. But as they change their agenda to put voting rights, suffrage, front and center, there's conflict. And some of that conflict is resistance from the male members, or perhaps even leadership of their own parties, right?
That's right. That's right. Yes.
Oh, that's really fascinating.
And the other difference with other suffragist movements all over the world was that in Spain, there were some national efforts to join forces, but there were many confrontations too between the different suffragist associations or different groups for women's rights, because there were many confrontations in terms of the general ideology inspiring these groups. So in a sense, conservatives and far left groups couldn't agree to fight for women's rights because there was a strong confrontation regarding other political ideas. So
they had to select which battle to pick.
Exactly. And most of them pick up the ideological battle, political, let's say, but not the politics of feminist demands. So these are all politics, but they pick up the part of politics which had to do with political parties and the system, monarchy versus republic, and so on.
And let me interrupt you, if I may, for a second, please. This is really interesting. So you have this liberal monarchy from 1875 to 1923. Then you have a government from 1923 to 1930, which is not a democracy. Mm-hmm. From 1930 to 1939, you get the Second Republic.
From 1931
to 1939.
So
the reason I go over that timeline again is that Spain is going through some really big political changes aside from what's happening to women's rights. So from time to time, political parties are picking and choosing, should we push the women's agenda or should we deal with democracy and republic? And that's what you're referring to.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, yes. That is fascinating. So women's rights becomes one of the many things that are happening at that time. Mm-hmm. So how does the Second Republic from 1931 to 1939 affect women's rights?
Well, the Second Republic meant great progress for Spanish women from the point of view of the legislation. So yeah, for a start, the electoral law for the election of the constitutional parliament allowed women to be elected. And as a result, we have the first three female MPs in Spanish history, the writer and art critic Margarita Nelken from the Socialist Party, and then the lawyers Clara Campoamor and Victoria Kent from two different Republican parties. So Clara Campoamor, who was a lawyer who was already practicing law before 1931, was key in changing the legislation and in shaping the legislation for the Second Republic.
Women become MPs, members of parliament, but they still cannot vote.
Exactly. So before having the right to vote.
Interesting.
It's interesting. Okay. Well, maybe I should have told you because I forgot to tell you that during the, this is a bit of a paradox, but it was like that. So during the Primo de Rivera dictatorship.
This is 1923 to 1930.
Exactly.
Okay.
They pass a piece of legislation called Municipal Statute, whereby women, single independent women plus widows were allowed both to vote, to cast their vote, and to be elected. But this law wasn't implemented in practice. But the dictator had to actually choose the local government representatives for the 8,000 municipalities we had in Spain at the time. So obviously he appointed people who backed him up. So people who were supporters of his idea of a regime. And our thesis is that he didn't have enough men supporting him. So he decided, and he also wanted to give this impression of being modern and being on the same page than other European countries. So he appointed the first female mayoresses and city councillors in Spanish history.
Appointed.
This precedent, yes. And then the electoral law was changed, but they didn't want to, they were really afraid of granting Spanish women the vote because they were really scared of having of doubling the electorate, because that was going to happen if they
exactly.
granted female vote. And on the other hand, they were really scared of women voting for the conservatives and against the Republic, putting the Republic in risk. That was the discourse which was produced.
Wait, I
by,
don't follow that, Dr. Del Moral. From what you're telling me, it seems like women would vote for the Second Republic, which is more progressive, because conservative politics, and by the way, I'm using conservative in American sense because that's what I know. Conservatives were the ones that had all these domesticity laws and the perfect women rules. So you would think that women would want to vote for the Second Republic, right?
Absolutely, but there was a strong campaign by the conservatives, and when I'm talking about the conservatives here, I'm referring to the Catholic and groups and monarchists. So at the you know, by 1931, we are referring to monarchists and Catholics who were former supporters of the monarchy, but also some supporters of the dictatorship of Primo de Rivera. Yeah. So these sectors of society were supporting the idea that women would vote for Catholic parties. Because that was that happened in Belgium at the when the Socialist Party tried to get the right to vote for women. So the conservatives in Belgium started to thread with the fact that, according to their views, women were controlled by the priests. So they would vote what the priests would have said or would have asked for. So this was, prejudicial idea was then published in Spanish newspapers, and they managed to convince both far left and left-wing political parties leaders, and also the right, that women might vote for the conservatives.
So was this a mere fear and propaganda, or do you think that women in fact would have voted for the conservative side because they were influenced?
There are loads of research conducted on that very controversial topic, and now we know that the first time Spanish women voted in a general election was in 1933, and that as a result we had a coalition of center and right-wing political parties. So after these results, women were accused of being the responsibles of that. But then in 1936, we had a far-left coalition in government. So, so obviously women weren't the responsible for these changes in
maybe
in
women
trend.
Were just voting like any voter, responding
exactly.
to politics.
That's
so
right. That's right.
So when did, we were talking about 1930 and 1936 and women are voting. When did women get the right to vote? Go ahead.
Clara Campoamor, as I said, took part in the parliamentary commission that drew up the constitutional draft to be discussed in parliament in 1931. And she was the one defending the right of women to vote against the view of this other part of the Republicans, represented by another woman, Victoria Kent, who was against granting the right to vote to women because she thought they weren't ready to vote for the Republic, that they would put the Republic in risk. But in the end, Clara Campoamor was more convincing, and she got the right to vote to be included within the 1931 Constitution, and equality between the sexes also. So
the
first time we've got a constitution which is which defended or granted equality between the sexes, and this also was translated to more changes within the law, such as equality within marriage, and also the passing of new laws such as the divorce and the civil marriage law.
That's a lot.
Yes. So, what Spanish history teaches us is that when there are progressive forces fighting for equality, they made a lot of progress. And then, but the backlash is really strong, too. when
before we go to the backlashes, I just wanted a clarification point here. Mm-hmm. Dr. Del Moral, this is not equality the same way in the late 19th century. This is not equal but different, right?
This is, no, this is
through
equal.
And through equal. Okay.
This is real equality.
This is real equality. Okay. And it's set in law now. Okay. Before we go to the next segment, there's something that it's been itching at me. I wanted to get a general sense, and that's education. In these early years of the 20th century, or even maybe the last decades of the 19th century, did women in Spain go to college?
Yeah, well, this is a very fair point, absolutely. I mean, between the 1900 and 1930, there was a considerable rise in literacy rates in general, but specifically among women. So just to give you some data.
Nice.
The decrease of illiteracy was very significant among women, having 66% of illiteracy in 1900, which was reduced up to 28% in 1939.
So illiteracy, lack of literacy,
exactly.
went down from 66% in 1900 to 23% in what year?
28% in 1939. So by the end of the Civil War.
Oh, wow, that's quick. Okay. And did that also include higher education? Is there any data to show women, for example, they came out doctors? Yeah. I think I know the answer to that. Yes, because you talked about women lawyers.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. This is a bit of an anecdote, but the first woman we know that attended lectures at university was Concepción Arenal, who was very interested in legislation. Concepción Arenal was the daughter of a liberal high-ranking army officer, and she was very interested in law. So she attended lectures at the university disguised as a man. And when they weren't allowed. So that happened in 1840. So when she was discovered, there was a big controversy.
Scandal, yeah.
A scandal, and she was asked to pass an exam. She passed it, and she was allowed to attend lectures at the university.
That's a wonderful story.
Yes. And then, there was a big gap. And then from the 1870s onwards, we had some women attending university, but that's just a few, just a bunch of them. The first one being, or one of the first ones being Maria Elena Maceras, who became a gynecologist. But they had, every one of them had to ask for a special permission, and they had to attend the classes being accompanied by someone, either the lecturer or the professor, and then being picked up from the university by a member of their families. So it was very difficult for them to actually follow, you know, higher education or attending classes at the university. But then everything changed with the passing of a new law in 1910, which eliminated this prerequisite of getting a permission from the rector to actually attend the university. So from that moment onwards, we started seeing the numbers of female students at higher education growing, and they were this got even or this trend got even stronger during the Second Republic years. Obviously,
were these women of the elite socioeconomic classes that could go to college, or was it sort of a meritocratic system where even women from lower classes could come?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, for instance, the example set by Maria Elena Macera, she was the daughter of a doctor. So she really wanted to become a gynecologist and to work as such.
And the one in 1840 was daughter of a general.
Yes, yeah. A liberal, progressive one. So okay. These were, most of them were, I mean, from the 1870s onwards, these were women who wanted to actually work as whatever they were studying, law or medicine or biology. And they were from the well-to-do upper classes, but not so much from the nobility. So the profile was that. So they wanted to work.
Kind of like upper middle class. You mentioned backlash, and I want to talk about that. And I think part of that comes during the Franco regime. You and I can talk about this period that we're engaged in for another 6 hours, Dr. Del Moral. Unless you have any more salient points to add here, we can take a break and go to the next segment.
Well, we can talk about the Franco's regime.
Okay, I think let's do that then. And we'll be right back after a short break to talk about Franco's Spain and Spain's macho culture. We'll be right back. In this episode, Dr. Del Moral tells us that the unwanted FIFA kiss was an act of masculine power over a woman. And that's not the first time we've heard this in our program. Back in 2021, in season 1, episode 27, when New York Governor Andrew Cuomo was accused of sexual harassment and shortly thereafter resigned, Dr. Carrie Baker of Smith College explained to us that, at its core, sexual harassment is about power. She also explained that since the term sexual harassment was first used in 1975, rates of sexual harassment in America have not really changed, which essentially means that for the last 48 years, real change has happened at a glacial pace in America's fight against sexual harassment. I've dropped a link for you to my conversation with Dr. Baker in the detailed caption of this episode. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Del Moral. Dr. Del Moral, how did Franco's regime alter women's conditions? Now we're talking like the Civil War, 1936 to 1939, and Franco becomes the ruler, dictator, whatever you want to call him, I think in 1939, right?
Yes. Well, the uprising against the Second Republic took place or started in July 1936, but it caused the division of the country into two zones, so the Republican and the Rebel zone, where the egalitarian and secular measures passed by the Republic were overturned from the very last moment. So as soon as they got that these zones under their control, they overturned the legislation. And then from 1939, that was the case in the entire country. So Franco...
You mean Franco's faction, the conservative faction that was also backed by the Catholic Church. They, from as soon as they started getting power within different regions of Spain, they overturned the legislation. And by 1939, when they have the whole country, those are already law. So they undid all the progress.
Yes, that was basically what they did, because Franco defended the traditional gender division of roles between men and women. And in July, for instance, in July 1938, a new law called Fuero del Trabajo, so it's like a working or a law for workers, was passed, establishing that women had to devote themselves to the household. And that was it. And then, obviously, they overturned the divorce and civil marriage laws passed back in 1932. And more importantly, all the divorces and marriages under this law were declared invalid. So can you imagine the social consequences of these measures?
I'm sorry, can we hold here for a second? So let's say you're a woman, your husband beats you. In 1935, you get a valid divorce because he's harassing you. But all of a sudden, in 1939, that same...
And you got married again.
And you got married. Oh, there you go. That's even more complicated. You're married again. And in 1939, that same abusive husband is now legally your husband?
Absolutely. Yeah. That was the case, yeah.
Did, and this is not meant to be pejorative or anything, but this is so against, this is almost like Spain being in a bubble. This is so against what's happening, let's say in France and Britain. Were Spanish people aware of this, that this is going backwards?
Well, in a way, there was
Spain. I'm not criticizing. I'm trying to.
No. I mean, in a way, Spain was part of a trend in Europe. By the far right. So think about Salazar's Portugal. Think about Mussolini's Italy. Think about Hitler's Germany.
That's a great point.
So, in terms of the gender relations, there were many parallels all over Europe. So we're talking about 1930s Europe, where, you know, there were extremes fighting for getting the majority of the countries. So yeah, it's the same thing.
Actually, in the context of time, the Axis power, you know, well, Portugal wasn't part of the Axis power, but that makes sense. That's a good perspective. Okay, so let's go on with Franco's time.
So yeah, there was also severe legislation against abortion, because as you probably know, during the civil war in Catalonia, there was this legislation legalizing abortion in 1937, but Franco obviously overturned that. And also additional legislation was passed against contraception. And then the two crimes, adultery and amancebamiento, the ones we talked about before, mm-hmm. they were reestablished. So all the, you know, the old articles within the civil and the criminal codes were again reestablished.
That is such an upheaval.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Go ahead, sorry,
I interrupted you. Yeah, well, I was going to say that even though this was the case, we cannot analyze the entire regime, the 40 years which the dictatorship lasted under mm-hmm. the same light, because some changes were introduced, and this happened from the late 1950s onwards. And this was due to the female lawyers who were still practicing, because they got their degrees before Franco got to power, and they were part of the Falange, the female section within Falange, which, as you probably know, Falange was the only party allowed. Official political party of the dictatorship, and the female section was formed by women who were the ones in charge of imposing this old ideal of domesticity back in Spain. So there were some female lawyers who were members of the regime, but who were critical of the way women were treated by this legislation, and they were the ones responsible for changing things from the late 1950s.
So how much did it change? How better did it get?
They achieved many things. For instance, one of the first examples was a lawyer called Mercedes Formica. She studied law during the Second Republic in Seville, and she was a member of the female section of Falange. And she was also wrote some articles for a conservative obviously, a conservative newspaper before Franco, and it continued, which was called ABC, ABC. So she published in 1953, she published an article titled The Conjugal Household.
And she was Conjugal Household.
Household. That was the legal term for the house. Well, that would become... I will explain later the title. So this was a journal article about a woman who had been killed by her husband. So she was denouncing the lack of protection for married women who were abused by their husbands. So she denounced the fact that within the civil code, women weren't allowed to flee from their houses even being subject to abuse by their husbands, because that would have been considered a crime. They would have been accused of abandoning the conjugal household or the house of the husband. So her point was that things should be changed. And she created such a controversy that she was even interviewed by the magazine, the American magazine Time. And Robert Capa sent a photographer to take her photo and interview her and published an article on her.
What year was that?
That was 1953. And then there was this big controversy around this topic. And from 1956 to 1958, she was having this debate with whoever wanted to discuss it with her. And in the end, she got a change within the code. So she got the changing of this conjugal household by conjugal domicile, whereby if there was a conflict between the husband and the wife, the judge was to decide who was supposed to stay at the conjugal domicile and who was supposed to leave. So in a case of a wife being abused by her husband, that would have granted her
this house. Is really interesting. So it's no longer just a husband's house. Now the judge gets to decide who's in the right, and that person, whether the woman or the man, gets the house. Okay, I see
that.
Right. I see the difference.
That's right.
I have a question to ask you about this period. But I've sort of in my own head, I think I've answered it. So I'll ask you anyway. I was going to ask you about what happened to women's voting rights during Franco's regime. But in my head, I realized that voting didn't really matter during Franco's regime. It was a dictatorship, right?
Well, yes, it was.
Is there more to that story?
Yes, a little bit more. Yeah, it gets complicated because obviously it was a dictatorship and there weren't any elections up to 1948, when the dictator decided to reestablish local elections. So this was a corporate state. So the right to vote was granted to three bodies within Spanish society: the official trade union, which was the Sindicato Vertical, as they call it. So this was the official trade union, compulsory for workers to join, and a third of the members within the municipalities had to be chosen from their representatives. And then there was another third from associations, either cultural or economic associations. And then the third, or these thirds, was the family third. And in this case, there were widows who were widows or single independent women who were also able to be elected and to vote. So from 1948, when these local elections took place, there was a chance of having women among the people who were elected and voters, obviously.
So from that perspective, women got the right to vote in local elections similar to men?
Not exactly, just because they were part of families with no male head.
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay, because of the family.
This old idea of families being represented, represented by the husband, which is the head of the family, but in his absence, women could play that role too.
I see. Yes, you explained that, and I missed it. This creates an interesting dichotomy, because if you're a son and you're single, and let's say you're 23, you're not represented by your father. You still live under your father's house, but you can vote. But your older sister and your mother cannot vote because they're represented by the father.
Yeah, well, women had to be independent, so they had to have their own house to have that right. Yeah.
Dr. Del Moral, I've come across this term several times, and I think we've discussed it in different flavors in the prior segment, but I just want to make sure I don't go away not understanding it. And the term is permiso marital. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
That's right. Yes, this this was a part of the articles within the civil code about the status of married women. So this was the idea that married women needed the authorization of their husbands to do or to carry out any act of a legal kind, such as selling their properties, I mean the wife's properties, or maybe managing it, managing them, or acting as a witness in front of a jury. So they were treated as children. They needed the the express authorization of their husbands for doing most things, opening a bank account. But that was also the case in Britain, for instance, and in the rest of continental Europe under these civil codes until they changed them. So yeah, it was pretty common.
And how long did this law last in Spain?
Well, in Spain, the changes started with these actions led by female lawyers. So these changes
within the party that you were talking about.
Yeah. Well, these articles were changed in the during the transition to democracy. So the articles of the criminal code were changed before that. So this idea of adultery and avanzamiento in 1963, they eliminated this article 428, which allowed the husband to kill their wife without having without expecting a big punishment for that. So that happened in 1963, but then the elimination of adultery and amancebamiento took place in 1973, and then equality between the wife and the husband was the result of the transition to democracy. So that was the result of taking equality within the law, which was included in 1978 Constitution, to the rest of the legislation,
which was also included in the 1931 Constitution original.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So, I want to talk about the transition to democracy, but before we end this segment, I want to ask you another clarification. A couple of times I saw this term and I thought nothing of it, but then I kept on seeing it again, and the term is Spain's macho culture.
Yeah.
what does that mean, especially in the context of women's rights?
Well, it's macho culture. It's just this idea of traditional attitudes of misogyny, so which includes a variety of cultural practices, such as or from undervaluing women's ideas and criteria. But also any form of discrimination against women or violence against women. So it's very, it just refers in this idea of macho is the Spanish word for macho culture is like saying male chauvinistic attitude.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. I figured that's what it is. I saw it so many times that I realized that this has a deeper and relevant meaning to women's rights. And we'll be back after a short break to talk about the post-Franco Spain and the transition. We'll be right back. Hey there, News Peelers. We're working on a brand new website with many super duper features, including videos of our guests and compilations of our episodes into series, with related blogs that are updated weekly, like series on U.S. politics, economy, health policies, environment, women's rights, and also series on many other countries, like Russia, Ukraine, China, and Brazil, and the British monarchy, and also a series on revolutions and protests, like those in Iran, Israel, and France. So be sure to check it out at historybehindnews.com. See you guys there. democracy returns to Spain in 1975. Mm-hmm. What happens then to women's rights?
Yeah, that, well, 1975 was the year of the death of Franco. So that happened in November on the 20th. But that year, I mean, and it marked the start of the transition to democracy, but it took a while to actually...
Oh, so it's not the start. The democracy doesn't return that year. There's a transition period. Okay.
It took a while. I mean, we can say that, they started... walking towards democracy. They started giving
walking
the first
towards.
Step towards it, but that wasn't the moment. So there were, I mean, all the structure of the regime was still in place in 76, 77, okay? But they will be dismantling this little by little. But 1975 is also important because United Nations named that year the International Year of the Woman. And that gave way to the organization of various activities. And one of them was the first feminist conference, which took place in December in Madrid.
Was
called Primeras Jornadas Feministas de Madrid in 1975. So 1 month or just a fortnight after the death of Franco. So this was part of the events organized by the female section of Falange, but under this cover, the feminist movement was reorganized.
So Franco dies in November, on November 20th, 1975. And within a few weeks in December, they have the first feminist conference in Madrid.
Which gives you the idea of how the idea that the feminist movement was already there. So there were new generations of university students, female workers, communist workers who were acting undercover, who were already spreading those ideas and trying to get organized. So this year marked the starting point of the second wave of the feminist movement in Spain.
Okay, and it takes a couple of years for the regime's structures, legal structures, to be dismantled, to be transformed. How does all of this affect women's rights? What new laws?
Well, we need to refer basically to the Constitution, 1978 Constitution, which reintroduced equality between the sexes and reinstated the right to vote in equal terms for both men and women, active and passive. And again, female lawyers were joining different bodies and they were taking an active part in developing all this legislation. For instance, we've got Maria Tello. Maria Tello started working as a lawyer before the death of Franco. She actually kept links with former leaders of the feminist movement, such as Clara Campoamor. So these were two generations, women or female lawyers from two different generations, keeping in touch and talking about women's rights and the way to reintroduce them. So Maria Tello, for instance, had a part in changing the civil legislation. So in 1981, she was key in reestablishing the equality between the husband and the wife within marriage. So eliminating all these articles from the civil code we've been discussing before.
These are all laws that we're talking about. Did Spain change culturally suddenly after, well, perhaps not suddenly, but after the death of Franco?
Well, not at all. Not even today. So we still have, I mean, it's very easy to change some legislation. So you can
exactly.
Do that
overnight. That's why I'm asking that. Yeah.
But yeah, cultural norms and social customs are not that easy to change. So that education is what plays a key role in changing those. So, but in a way, the transition years were more progressive. So that then we have had some backlashes afterwards.
Oh.
So, for instance, The divorce law was passed in 1981, and also the abortion law in 1985. And this created a...
You mean allowing abortion, legalizing,
yes,
okay.
The legalizing abortion, yep. The first one for the entire country being passed in 1985. And obviously this was very controversial, and it created a big debate, heated debates, back in the 1980s. But then there was a strong backlash on that issue in the 21st century. So it's not a linear, it's not linear. So we can see this backlash.
Actually, to some extent, that's the same thing is happening here in the United States. We had liberalization of women's rights, and now there is backlash, if you will.
Exactly.
And some of it comes in the United States from a very dedicated, committed, strong minority. It's not necessarily the majority. I don't know what the politics is like in Spain. Several years ago, now stretching a decade ago in the US, we had the big Me Too movement, and the sexual harassment and the movement against it was again became front and center. But the sexual harassment movement, actually the name even goes back to the 1970s in the US, and it sort of comes after the civil rights movement has already been established in the 1960s. Did Spain experience something similar? Did they call it sexual harassment? The movement against sexual harassment?
Yeah, absolutely. Spain was very much in contact with all these transnational demands by the second wave of the feminist movement. So it's completely, I mean, they were their political agendas were the same in Spain, in the United States, in France. So they were campaigning for the same kind of rights, including, I mean, you know that reproductive rights, as they call them in general, so including abortion, contraception, but also sexual harassment, etc., were the most important set of demands of the second wave of the feminist movement, and also in Spain. But in recent years, we've also joined this Me Too movement, not only because of what has recently happened with the unwanted kiss of Rubiales to Hermoso.
FIFA.
But yeah, but before that, we had this case which created great public rage, this so-called Manada rape case, which took place during the San Fermines, you know, the celebrations in Pamplona in July 2016. So that was a gang rape of an 18-year-old woman by these five men who filmed themselves repeatedly attacking this woman. So this created...
Filmed themselves?
Yes, that was what happened. And it was even more serious because the men were cleared of sexual aggression charges.
I'm sorry. You mean they were exonerated? They were...
Well, not exactly. They were cleared of sexual aggression charges and instead found guilty of sexual abuse. And the reason was the way the legislation had been drafted. So the prosecution could not prove they employed violence against the victim. And because they had to comply with this evidence that was compulsory under the legislation in place at the time, they got away with the crime of sexual aggression, even though it was evident for everyone what had happened there. So that prompted a strong reaction among all sectors of society.
I bet.
And there were massive demonstrations in support of the victim and in support of the feminist movement. So from the first time in history, in Spanish history, the term feminism wasn't considered pejorative or it wasn't taken as having negative connotations, but for the first time, it had a complete positive connotation. Nice. In defending women's rights and specifically sexual rights for women. So this was the reason why the Minister of Equality passed the what is called the Sexual Freedom Law in 2022. It's also called the Law of Yes is Yes. I'm sure you've came across this expression, CSC, Ley de CSC, which actually focuses on the consent by the victim in order not to give the opportunity to the juries to actually discredit the victim's testimony.
Oh, so they're
they
saying
have to trust the victim.
So the slogan is yes, it's not that no is no.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, interesting.
So there has to be express consent to have sexual intercourse. And it is not, I mean, that is not that the prosecutors need to prove that there was violence, that she was, that in some way she might have agreed to the intercourse. So now the focus is displaced from that and now it's placed on consent of the victim in order to prevent the justice system to discredit the victim.
Yeah, work around that. I'm just still baffled about the fact that they couldn't prove violence in a gang rape. And I mean, that's almost prima facie case of violence. I mean, you know, what else? Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Dr. Del Moral as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Dr. Del Moral, you mentioned this in the last section, the unwanted kiss, where Luis Rubiales forced a kiss on the lips of Jennifer, Ms. Jennifer Hermoso. And, you know, with the background of 2016, this struck a nerve in Spain and frankly around the world. So is there anything specific about this event, the kiss, that stood out for Spanish women?
Well, it's just this unwanted kiss was could be interpreted as a global manifestation of the fact that still some men and some Spanish institutions feel that they are entitled to use a woman's body as they feel fit. So that's the reason. I mean, the fact that she grasped her head and gave her a kiss on the lips was an act of masculine power over a woman.
Exertion of power, yeah.
Exactly. So that created, I mean, in a society like the Spanish one, where we do have this idea that, well, not that idea, but it's a fact that we are one of the most advanced countries in terms of the legislation for women's rights.
Nice.
The fact, I mean, we've got all this legislation developed from the early years of the 21st century against violence against women within marriage and outside marriage and other measures taken towards real equality, not just saying that we're just equal and that's it, but implementing effective measures in practice in all fields or possible fields, such as the working environment, education, et cetera, political representation. So we do have this very advanced legislation, but still we haven't managed to change the attitudes of some men and some institutions, which are very traditional in the way they conceive the position of women. And they think, or they feel, or both, that they can do whatever they please with them. So that really outraged Spanish society in general and the world.
World society, yeah.
Way, exactly. So this shows how...
Can we use the term macho for this attitude?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
That applies very accurately to what happened. So, however, the backlash against Rubiales shows also not only how strong the support for women's rights in Spain is, but also the fact that in general, so Spanish society is not allowing this to happen anymore and not to be so evident for everyone. So it is still happening in the private realm, so we still need to act against that. But these kind of attitudes in public institutions are not longer allowed. And I think the reaction by the institutions was, or is being, let's see what happens. But I hope that this is gonna prompt a change within social
I hope so too. One of the things that we loved here in America is that the name of the Spain's women's soccer team is now called Spanish National Football Team. So, you know, they've taken out the gender. We are the national team. I love it. Is there anything that Spanish women are lacking in their rights, whether legal or cultural, in comparison to, I don't know, other European countries or perhaps Canada and the United States? Is there anything big that stands out? I mean, we can go state by state, but that's not what I mean, just generally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think there's nothing lacking. I mean, we are in different positions in terms of specific indicators about equality. We can talk about that, but that's very detailed. But yeah, in general terms, I think we are on the same page and we are confronting the same challenges for the future, because there's this part of society which is not willing to accompany us in this progress, meaning that, you know, improving women's conditions, improving women's rights is improving the entire society's conditions, so and daily living, so or ways of living. So I think that's the same challenge very much for American, Canadian, and British or French or Spanish women.
Yeah. One interesting point, not relevant to that question I just asked, just an interesting point that you and I discussed during the break, I wanted to share with the audience, is that it's interesting that in history, for example, in the 1930s, Germany, Portugal, Italy, and other parts of history, dictators, one of the first things they do is go after women's rights. You know, that's one of the things that they limit. If you wanted our audience to remember just one point about women's rights in Spain, after everything we talked about, what would that be? I'm putting you on the spot here.
Yeah, well, overall, I think that the history of women's rights is not just in Spain, but everywhere. It's a history of a lot of progress, but also setbacks or backlashes. So we need to keep that in mind. So it's not a linear progression. So this is the case in Spain. And I think we've given a lot of examples of that unequal or maybe not linear trend. So in that sense, changing legislation is useful, but I think it's more useful to change the way people behave, and that's cultural norms and practices.
That takes active engagement. That's not one and done. You can't let it go. It's not done.
Exactly. And that's, I think, education, not just formal education, but education within every single realm. I mean, within the family, within all sort of communities, either religious or lay. So I think that's the general idea, which actually we can learn from studying the past.
Exactly. Dr. Del Moral, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective. Thank you so much, Dr. Del Moral.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research, and we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past, rather is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.